Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a special Pints and Politics edition of River to River, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio, today coming to you from the Scottish Rite Temple in Cedar Rapids. I'm Ben Kiefer.
And I'm Aaron Jordan.
Okay, we're glad to be here among you once again to share brews and political views. I didn't mean that to rhyme. Aaron, would you introduce the panel before I do more damage here?
I would love to, Ben. So tonight, for Pints in Politics, we have our usual political panel here. First, we've got Todd Dorman, Gazette's editorial page editor and columnist. In the middle, we've got Linda Waddington, Gazette columnist. And James Lynch, political reporter.
Let's jump right in with what would arguably be the biggest political news in the country from this past week. And a question, Aaron, lines up with it well, that was handed to me. First of all, what should be done about Trump and Rocket Man to make peace, not war? Of course, referring to the president's speech before the UN General Assembly, full of fiery nationalism, the lines we take away, Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and his regime. President also threatening to totally destroy North Korea, a country of 26 million people. So let's talk a little bit about, averting war would be one good thing. How this changes the U.S.'s leadership in the world to hear a speech like this coming from a U.S. president?
Well, every time the subject turns to foreign policy, I always feel a little bit out of my element. I talk about topsoil, maybe. I think for North Korea, their regime basically is fueled by this, propaganda idea that the United States wants to destroy them, and now we have an American president who basically fills in the blanks and says, yeah, they're right, we do want to destroy you. So that's, I don't know how that works as far as a negotiating stance, because, I mean, in the end, you want to work this out in some way that avoids war. It just seems like the rhetoric on both sides is pushing us toward a point where we don't want to get to, and I think that's what most people are worried about. And it also makes it harder to maneuver in places like Iran and elsewhere when you use that kind of rhetoric. I mean, that's what makes it difficult. That's not usually what the United States does to sort of work out these kind of differences.
What struck me about the president's speech at the United Nations is that it struck me that he was trying to take a tough love tone, when he was talking about other nations and that, we're sovereign nations and, of course, I put America first and you put your country first and that's the way it should be, because if I put America first and you put your country first, we're going to work together to common goals and all that. But it seemed like it fell short. It was tough, but I'm not sure there was any love in it. So I think for people listening, leaders of other nations listening, it might have been like, whoa. The United States is stepping back from sort of the leadership role it's held by default for a long time. And I'm not sure that Americans are comfortable stepping back from that leadership role. Sometimes it seems like we're being the world policeman, we're bearing the cost of keeping peace, which doesn't seem to be going all that well. Yeah, it seemed like the president was, without turning foreign policy completely over, was sort of stepping back from that role that we've filled as the world leader in setting a lot of foreign policy, even beyond our borders.
Yeah, and as someone who had a brother who was lost in Vietnam and who has a teenage son at home, of all the things that are happening in the world, this is the one that makes me really apprehensive, because I don't see a way out from where President Trump put us. I mean, before you could do some type of negotiation, you could do diplomacy, you could have conversations. I don't see conversations taking place. When the only option, and parents can back me up on this, when your only option when you're dealing with discipline is to say, you will stop that or else, you've bought into or else.
Well, I mean, you know, it seems like the hallmark of sort of, you know, kind of rogue regimes is hollow rhetoric. I mean, we're going to kill you at the gates of Baghdad. We're going to bring the mother of all battles. I mean, you don't believe any of that. So for the United States to use that kind of hollow rhetoric is just, I mean, it sort of puts us in that rhetorical league, which I don't think that's where we want to be.
It does make us confront some sort of central key questions here that we've been on a sort of this glide path toward for many years. And I wanted to sort of test our audience here of at least 100 to ask a question that is central to this discussion with North Korea. Clap, applaud, if you are willing to live in a world where North Korea has nuclear-tipped ICBMs that can reach the United States. Clap if you're willing to accept that. Okay, a smattering out there, the majority not. So for those who are not willing to accept that world, this is a bad thing to applaud for, but I don't have any other way to do it. Are you willing to sacrifice Seoul, South Korea, to get rid of this threat?
No.
So there's the box that Linda just described, right?
Right.
It's been there for a long time, hasn't it? Since the latest leader of North Korea took power.
Yeah. There are no good options. And actually, maybe the best option is where we're at right now with two people barking at each other. And you have to hope that neither one of them is willing to actually pull the trigger. You know, it's not a good idea that North Korea has nuclear-tipped ICBMs. It certainly doesn't make the world safer for them to have that capability. And I would like to think that the United States, Donald Trump, regardless of Donald Trump, has more maturity in these sorts of affairs and more self-discipline in its use of nuclear weapons. We tried it once, and we haven't tried it again. And so there are no good options. You know, are we willing to bomb North Korea and lose South Korea? That isn't a very good option. Are we willing to live with North Korea firing off missiles every week and each one getting a little closer to some target rather than just falling in the ocean?
Yeah. And I also think we have kind of this natural issue with the way the United States chooses presidents and the way that our policies change and they go forward, you know, where we will go in with diplomacy and we will say, we need for you not to have these weapons. We need for you to do these things, and we create sanctions and we do whatever, and we start to bring those levels of weaponry down. But then presidents change, and policies change, and values change. And suddenly these countries who have complied with what we told them to comply with have new rules. And we end up, you know, going in and trying to push for regime change anyway. So that backdrop, combined with what's going on now with Korea, makes a very strange situation because I can't see an out. And maybe someone else can, and I hope there are smarter people out there who can.
Well, fortunately, cooler heads are prevailing. We have a breaking news story that says North Korean leader responds to Trump, quote, "I will surely and definitely tame the mentally deranged U.S. dotard with fire."
Dotard?
Thank you for bringing that forward,
dotard.
Zach.
Dotard.
So our panelists...
I feel better.
Dotard. Panelists...
I think things are calming down.
Yeah.
So you are all wordsmiths. I'm going to put you on the spot. What is a dotard?
I don't think it's a term of endearment.
So we're going to leave North Korea
We're going to come back stateside. So we have a new proposal this week to overturn Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. You know, I've already heard a lot of critics of it, even including other Republicans. What do the panelists think of the chances that this will make it through?
Well, according to Senator Grassley, they're still a few votes short of passage, and he doesn't know where they're going to find the votes. So, you know, depending on your point of view, that may be good news or bad news. But yeah, it seems to me that they're in the same spot they were the last time they tried this, that there are some Republican senators who are just unwilling to undo all of Obamacare or major portions of it. So I'm not really sure how they get even to the 51 votes they need if they do it through reconciliation.
Well, the problem is that there are quite a few Republican senators, or a fair number, that are hearing from Republican governors that are saying, this would be really bad for our Medicaid program. Yes, we might get some flexibility. The problem is that the funding would be severely cut. States that expanded Medicaid would basically be punished under the bill. States that didn't expand Medicaid would get more money. One Republican governor that seemed to like it was ours, Kim Reynolds, who didn't seem to be too concerned about the fact that Iowa was one of the 34 states that would lose quite a bit of funding. She pointed to welfare reform, but I mean, these are two very different. Medicaid and welfare reform are very different. I mean, you're looking at the prospect of kicking thousands of people out of their health insurance. So I think that's, you know, this idea of giving states flexibility is sort of the selling point, although under Senate rules and with the reconciliation, there's some indication that maybe they can't get that part of the bill passed through reconciliation. So its selling point may actually not happen anyway. So I think that's one of the problems they're facing, mm-hmm. getting votes.
And the other piece to it is that it isn't a forever bill. So we're not looking at fixing health care from this point on. We're looking at fixing health care until 2026. And at that point, if it's not reauthorized, the entire bottom falls out, and there's no community block grants, there's no money going to the states. So how do we get the health insurance companies and all these other people on board to build yet another system that's only going to be good for a few years?
Well, and Governor Reynolds is embracing this, even as we don't know how much the current Medicaid system is going to cost, because the negotiations over what we're going to pay to the managed care companies are still ongoing behind closed doors. And so we already have a system that may be budgetarily challenged, and if you take more federal money away from it, I'm not sure how that's a good bill.
It seems like one area that people agree on is there should be more flexibility. The problem is that all the flexibility is getting rid of what people like about Obamacare. Pre-existing conditions, you can stay on your parents' insurance until you're 26. Some of those sorts of things that are the most popular parts of Obamacare, when those are the flexible things that will go away or could go away under this proposal.
You know, we talk a lot about ideology and how people view things different way. You know, what we have here is a state's rights bill. So you have the Republicans saying the states need to do this. Let's just give them the money and they know the best way to do these things. But what happened to patient rights? I mean, we haven't seen that. So it's kind of become states' rights versus patient rights.
Alongside this, not too many days ago, we had Bernie Sanders come out with a single payer, a book. In fact, he was on my program, a book that talks about Bernie Sanders' revolution and the need for a single payer health insurance. And then we have 15 or 16 co-sponsors in the Senate line up with Bernie Sanders. Is that a litmus test? Was that too early? Is now, with the backdrop of Obamacare and the aftermath of Obamacare, is single payer something that can gain enough support, or was that just a Bernie thing for the left side of the Democratic Party?
I think it's becoming a litmus test for anybody who is thinking about running in 2020. You know, it's sort of like he's thrown the gauntlet down, and if you want to get the support of the Bernie-crats, you have to, you know, be supportive of single payer, and maybe, I mean, maybe that's a good thing, because in the past we've had this sort of
hybrid Obamacare that really wasn't single payer, but anybody who looked at it was like, it's going to lead us there. So maybe we just really need to have that debate, single payer or not. And maybe the 2020 election will sort of resolve that. Probably not, but, you know, we could hope.
So is the panel in agreement next week? Mitch McConnell said there'll be a vote on Graham Cassidy. Are you in agreement that next week Graham Cassidy will be as much of a has-been as David Cassidy?
Whoa.
Hey, wait a second.
So punny.
That's the beer talking.
Well,
I'm sorry.
But isn't he on the casino circuit now?
Maybe you met Sean Cassidy.
No, he came after David Cassidy.
Oh, right, yeah. It, never bet on Congress passing something. I mean, big and complicated and major. I mean, that's just not something that's happening. I mean, this whole debate shows you, you know, that the center has disappeared. I mean, we've got, let's scrap Obamacare and throw, you know, millions of people out of their health care, or let's have single payer. I mean, that's where we're at. Those seem to be the two choices right now. And there's some talk in between of, you know, John Kasich and Hinkenlooper from Colorado have written op-eds together trying to get some sort of bipartisan plan started, but there doesn't seem to be, you know, any appetite for that. It's, we're going to have this debate between the edges of the spectrum, and that's where we are.
If you just joined us, it's a special edition of River to River, Pints and Politics, before a live audience at this time at the Scottish Rite Temple in Cedar Rapids. Ben Kiefer with my co-host here, Aaron Jordan of the Gazette, also political reporter James Lynch, columnists Linda Waddington and Todd Dorman of the Gazette, and a very enthusiastic audience of, I'll just say, political junkies out there. You're turning up for this sort of public event. Let's sort of talk a little bit about, since we last met at the very end of August, Hillary Clinton came out with her book, What Happened, the title of the book. Before we get to the panel, I want to get to the audience. You have two options here, care, don't care. Clap if you care about Hillary's view of what happened. Clap now if you don't care. Pretty evenly, yeah. Pretty balanced audience out there. No, copies of the book, you were hiding them under the table before you sat down. Come on, Todd, it's on your nightstand, isn't it?
No, I haven't read it. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I've heard about it, though.
Spoiler alert, but she lost.
She lost.
That's what happened?
Yeah.
It was a cliffhanger, but yeah, in the end, there was quite a twist, actually.
I would say, in its reporting and predictions, the media lost and the pollsters lost as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I that's fair to say.
So Hillary has ruled herself out for 2020. So what, when she removes herself from the picture, sort of, what goes into that void?
Well, yeah, right now Bernie is filling that void, Bernie Sanders. And I think the question is sort of not who fills the void, but who's the counter to Bernie Sanders. I mean, if you look at the Democratic Party right now, I think the enthusiasm is, the people who are enthusiastic about 2018 and 2020 are folks who were for Bernie. The people, I'm guessing that the people who supported Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders in the primary and the caucuses haven't landed on one candidate yet. They're still searching for who their champion is going to be in 2020.
What do you guys think about the Kasich Hickenlooper ticket?
It won't fit on a bumper sticker.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's going to be an extra big yard
Doesn't
sign.
Doesn't he just go by Hick? Isn't that...
Yeah. Kasich and Hick.
Well, maybe that does Kasich well Looper. In rural red states. I don't know, Hick. It's not exactly what you want to put on your lawn in small town Iowa.
So besides the United Nations talk, some of the biggest news over the last month or so has been about natural disasters. You know, at our last time we talked about Hurricane Harvey, and now we have Irma and other tropical storms. We've got a large share of western states with wildfires. We've got the earthquake in Mexico City. You know, a lot of these things, you know, we had a climate change panel today as part of Iowa Ideas talking about global warming and how it brings about a lot more of this severe weather. You know, do you guys think that the what we're seeing is going to make climate change any more part of the national dialogue?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think... As much as some people would like to deny climate change, it's getting harder and harder to ignore it and deny it. And I think that, you know, sort of whether you want to call it climate change or not, all these things are happening. So, you know, we have to deal with it. Get real, folks. You know, these wildfires are worse than they were last year and the year before and 10 years ago and 20 years ago. The severity of weather, you know, is bad. If you don't want to call it climate change, don't call it climate change, just call it bad weather, but the consequences are the same, and we, if we acknowledge that fact, we may be able to do something to protect ourselves in the future. I'm not hopeful.
Well, I think there's it's going to spark the conversation, but the political will just still isn't there, at least, you know, especially on the right side of the spectrum, to do anything. It's still sort of this tribal issue where people just can't bring themselves to accept it because the politics of it don't agree with them. I mean, it's just, it comes down to that in a lot of ways. I mean, I'm pessimistic, which, you know, probably isn't a surprise. That's what happens when you spend your life in journalism and you watch politics. But, I mean, you know, it's, I think, you know, for me, I hope we can at least focus on preparation and focus on what we do need to do from an infrastructure standpoint and a land planning standpoint and a building standpoint to sort of, you know, prepare for the new reality that we really don't, I mean, when it rains 50 inches in Houston, we just really don't know. I mean, the National Weather Service, they have to come up with new colors for their maps because the rain is like, well, what do we put for 50? Try purple. I mean, you know, I hope at least we can agree to sort of change the way we plan cities and live on coasts, because this is happening. And if we're not going to do anything about the root cause because we can't agree on carbon trading and things like that, then at least, you know, we should be able to agree that Cedar Rapids needs a flood wall, for instance, instead of delaying funding for years. I mean, these are priorities we need to have now.
Back in just a moment. It's a special edition of River to River, Pints and Politics, today coming to you from the Scottish Rite Temple in Cedar Rapids. James Lynch, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and Aaron Jordan on the stage with me. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a special edition of River to River, Pints and Politics, today coming to you from the Scottish Rite Temple in Cedar Rapids. Ben Kiefer with my co-host Aaron Jordan, also from the Gazette, James Lynch, Linda Waddington, and Todd Dorman of the Gazette. Pints and Politics, we like to do this every month or so, and in the break there, we usually say, go fill up your pint glasses, right? But we don't have beer on draft today, so we have get your new cans, and we're renaming the show, by the way. It's not called Pints and Politics. It's called Cans and Carping.
Oh, I like that.
Is that good? Is that good?
Tonight, the show, if you recycle the show, you get a 5-cent deposit.
Yeah.
That's a change.
Aaron, we want to focus on state and municipal politics. What do we want to talk about, first of all?
Well, so this week there was a news conference yesterday where Governor Reynolds announced that we're less far into the hole than we thought we were. So that's good news. We thought that the lower than expected state revenues might be as much as $100 million. And she announced that it was $14.6 million. I guess I wanted to ask, you know, the what you think about this. How does this set Governor Reynolds up for what some of her priorities might be in the next legislative session?
Good luck.
Yeah.
I don't think it sets her up very well at all, even though going from $104 million shortfall to $14 million is quite a feat. That I'd kind of like to see the work on that math problem, how they did that. But I think it still leaves her and the legislature and all of state government in a really hard spot. I mean, they're still in the hole, as you said, just not as far as they thought. It's going to make it very tough next year when the legislature meets. They're not going to have the resources to do many of the things people would like to see them do. I think, earlier this week, Aaron and you and Rod Beauchart reported on the likelihood or the possibility that they won't honor the backfill, which is money the state paid to local governments to make up for money the local governments lost when the state cut commercial property taxes. Everybody got that? Okay. I'm glad I don't have to explain it. If they do that, it's going to create havoc. And that's probably putting it mildly, create havoc for local governments because they're going to have to turn around and raise local property taxes, and that's never popular. It's good news, but it's not good news.
Anything to add, you two?
Oh. Well, anytime you can keep the legislature from coming back to Des Moines, I guess is a good thing. Well, I mean, there's so much uncertainty. We mentioned earlier that the cost of the Medicaid program is still sort of unknown, which could throw the current 2018 budget off of balance. I mean, we've got revenue estimates coming up in October and December that may or may not show a rosier picture. So the prospect for more budget cuts are possible. And just the revenue picture as a whole, as James alluded to, what sort of priorities can you fund, which will leave you with an election year session where they do things that don't cost money, which usually means social issues and lots of good ideas that they can put on campaign brochures. So no special session is good news, but the budget is still, mired in a lot of bad news. And with this healthcare debate in Congress, what's the funding going to look like going forward? I mean, there's all sorts of clouds on the horizon.
I changed my mind. I do have one thing to say.
Good.
The story that Aaron and Rod wrote, if you read through it, they actually talked to a person at the State Department of Management, I believe, a budget guy, who basically said, good luck untangling it. So my problem with the property tax reform is that we've cut multifamily residential dwelling, we've cut commercial, on the promise that we're going to get job expansion or business expansion and job creation. People would either have stabilized rents or reduce rents. But according to this person, we have no way to measure any of that because it's all too complicated. So if we can't account for what we're doing as a state, why are we doing it?
Yeah, well, that's sort of the theme of a lot of the tax breaks and credits and exemptions that have been passed over the years. Seemingly small at the time, add up to billions over time. We pass them, there are promises made, and the idea that, later we can measure the success or failure of that, we don't get around to doing that. We just continue to lose that revenue, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of political will to weed that garden of tax breaks. So it could get to the point where revenues go low enough and the budget situation gets dire enough that we do have that conversation, but it hasn't happened yet. There's talk of tax reform. Maybe it happens within that scope, but I mean, it seems like in an election year, the emphasis of tax reform is probably going to be on tax reduction, and I'm not sure with revenues where they are, how they can figure out how to do that.
Well, and that's what I have been struck by, is how the word reform usually means that someone gets a tax cut. So I've stopped using that word in my stories because I don't think it's accurate to what is really happening. I wanted to ask you, you know, President Trump has nominated Ag Secretary Bill Northey for a position at USDA. So the next big question is, who would fill his shoes as the Iowa Secretary of Ag? And Todd, you had written this week about who some of the names were that have been thrown out there. And I wanted to ask you about that and ask you, too, are any of those names someone who might address water quality?
Well, I'm working off James Lynch's short list he wrote about.
Dream team.
So, yeah. So, he does the real reporting, and I just come in and have my little opinions, you know. So, but, you know, and the column I wrote was basically that none of the, you know, Pat Grassley, state representative, is on the list. Annette Sweeney, who is a former state representative.
Dan Zumbaugh,
state senator, current state senator.
Tim Kapuchian. Yeah. Craig Hill from the Farm Bureau.
Yeah. I mean, these are all very, you know, conventional agricultural voices that are probably in, you know, agree with sort of the conventional large agriculture stance on water quality, which is, well, let's put some money into a lot of various projects and sort of count the projects. And the idea, you know, that we do a lot of, you know, real intensive water quality monitoring to see if we're doing, you know, making progress, things like that, are less popular with that group. So I think most of them fall into line with where Bill Northey has been on water quality. He would like to have more money, more investments, but in programs that we've basically been trying over the years to sort of do, you know, things that do work, but maybe less targeted and less accountable than they should be.
And I think it's instructive that all of those people who are on that short list, when asked about the job, said, oh, man, big shoes to fill. Bill Northey has done a great job. So I don't get any sense that they're looking to go in a new direction on anything, including water quality.
Yeah, I think your best bet for Iowa agriculture, since we know all these people are going to be basically the same on a lot of these issues, is to get the person who can best manage another avian flu outbreak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who can work really well with the federal government when something like that happens, because that's still out there and it could come back.
Pints and Politics, a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio, partnering up with The Gazette, listening to reporter James Lynch, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, columnist with The Gazette, my co-host Aaron Jordan of The Gazette. Answering also questions from our audience here at the Scottish Rite Temple in Cedar Rapids. You know, here's a question that pops up that has a bearing, you know, in a sort of wide sense to what Todd and you, James, I think have been writing about. The question here, what do you believe motivates people to become engaged in local politics? And I know, James, you wrote a recent story about town hall meetings. Todd, you wrote about this as well. So what was the gist of it? The town hall meetings, are they keeping up with the times? Are they performing a valuable function? What were you looking at there?
Well, especially earlier this year, we saw a lot of these town hall meetings sort of go ballistic with huge crowds showing up, people being very loud, boisterous, rude, ill-mannered, whatever you want to call it. And I mean, if you've gone to these in the past, you know, usually you get a handful of people. They've, you know, have predictable questions, and everybody goes home happy. They didn't get what they wanted, but at least they feel good about being there and feel good that their member of Congress was there. That's not the case since the 2016 election, and I think a lot of it was a chance. People saw it as a chance to sort of voice their indignation with the outcome of the election, and whether that's productive or not, somebody else can decide that. But yeah, I mean, it's just this, there's a lot of frustration, there's a lot of anger, angst among voters, and it's a chance to speak out. On the other side, for the members of Congress, yeah, some of them don't see it as being particularly productive. Some of them see it as sort of part of the job. So, you know, and I guess I respect those people who go ahead and have those meetings and stand there and take the abuse. Maybe they deserve it, maybe they don't. But, yeah, just stand in the gap there. Take some courage.
Yeah, I'm going to pop in the middle because I disagree with one thing you said, that this has been since the 2016 election. And as someone who followed Bruce Braley around Iowa during the Affordable Care Act discussion and other members of Congress, this is not something that's just from this past election. I mean, this is something that goes back to maybe 2005, if not earlier, that town halls have become very aggressive for the people who are attending them.
Do you see in covering town halls that candidates are learning on a learning curve in terms of dealing with hostile elements in their audiences or hostile audiences? I think if it's still on Joni Ernst, Senator Ernst's schedule, she will be at the union at the University of Iowa, which will not be the same for her as being in the western part of the state.
Yeah, there's a difference, and Chuck Grassley actually talked about this, that he said that, you know, as soon as he would start to answer a question, people would start shouting at him, so he would just go on to the next question. Rather than, I mean, if you've ever been to one of his town meetings, he'll usually give a fairly full answer to a question. But as soon as people would start yelling at him, it was like, well, what's the point? Let's go on to the next question. So I think that's one strategy. We saw Congressman Bruce Braley said, you know, you had to be a resident of the first district to participate in his town hall meetings. What did I say?
You said Braley.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Rod Blum said you had to be a resident of the district to participate. So, yeah, you see some of those strategies. On the other hand, Grassley and Ernst, it's just like open the doors and, you know, deal with whoever comes in.
Well, it's, you know, I think there's still value in them. And I mean, there is, you know, the public, the crowd does have some responsibility. If you want to have politicians have town hall meetings, shouting them down, screaming them down is not a good strategy for accomplishing that. That said, I mean, I think part of the angst and frustration, as I wrote, is that I think people feel like they're not being heard. And so when they go to a town hall meeting, they come at it from the standpoint that, by God, someone's going to listen to me this time. And I think that's the frustration. I don't think having fewer town hall meetings, curtailing your public engagement, only seeking out audiences that agree with you and that are glad to see you is going to be a remedy for that degree of frustration. I think you have to go out, you have to take your lumps and try. And I think if Rod Blum had more town hall meetings, he might find, as Joni Ernst has found and others, that they may become more civil over time as people figure out, hey, I've got more chances to engage. This person is actually interested in what we have to say. Maybe I don't agree with them, but I think limiting it to people in the district set him up for a situation where people were ready to pounce. I mean, I just think that set up a bad atmosphere. I think you just need to sort of open the doors and let people in and take your lumps. And I think that's what people expect when you run for the big office in the fancy buildings with the nice pay and perks, is that occasionally you're going to get yelled at.
And, you know, I don't know if this has changed, but when I wrote about this before, Chuck Grassley was the only person who put his public schedule out on his website. So what does that say to the people that you're representing, the people that you go to every 4 or 6 years and ask for your vote? If you're not going to put the schedule out on the website so people can come see you when you are back in the state. And I absolutely stand by what I wrote before. If you're not brave enough to come into Iowa, you know, the first caucus state in the nation, where we sit down with presidents and we shake their hands, then you don't deserve to have that office, period.
So, James, you had an article recently, I think it was based on a Rod Sullivan newsletter. He's a Johnson County supervisor, and he had suggested that perhaps Johnson County residents should consider the namesake of the county. For many who did not know, including myself, Johnson County is named after the ninth vice president of our country, Richard M. Johnson. He was a slave owner with a common law wife who was black. He and his wife had two children, and he did provide them inheritances, but he also called his children his property. So Sullivan had suggested that maybe Johnson County would be better off named after Dwayne the Rock Johnson or some other Johnsons with that name. But so, you know, Jim, I'm just curious, you know, is this just food for thought, or is there any momentum there?
Wait, did Rod propose a logo for the new Johnson County?
Not that, to my knowledge, no. But, you know, this is a debate that's ongoing. I mean, with the Confederate statues, the Confederate monuments, you know, what is the proper way to, you know, what should we do with these monuments? You know, are they a part of our history? Are they, like, you know, are they hurtful for minority populations? And once you start down this road, there is sort of like, where do you go from here? I mean, you know, you can start with Washington. You can go basically through the whole succession of precedents, and they all had their faults. So, I mean, yeah, I don't know where you go with that. I think you are probably among the 99.9% of Johnson County residents who did not know which Johnson they were named, the county was named for, and probably had no knowledge of Richard Mentor Johnson and his multicultural family.
But now we do.
Now you do, and perhaps you don't feel good about that.
Somehow I get the feeling of the statue debate, removing statue debate. When thinking about it, I remember, you know, learning about the Civil War in elementary school growing up in Cedar Falls. And I wonder if our audience had the same experience, that when I think back about the reasons we were given, what the South was fighting for, it was not slavery. That's not what I learned about in elementary school. And I just heard that's right. It was about, help me out, states' rights, the right to secede from the Union. So it made me think, maybe we have some historians in our panel, or an element. Was it sort of a whitewash to make, to allow us to honor the South, to put up these statues, and that we never really came to terms with what the South's aims were and what the people at that time were fighting against and fighting for? Sounds like people in the audience had some of the same experience that I did.
Yeah.
And I think you would find that people who grew up in the South, or people who live in the South, have a much different perspective on the war of Northern aggression than those of us who grew up in North Country here. And I don't think we've ever come to grips with that, completely come to grips with it. And I don't know if we ever will. And probably as long as those monuments exist, they're going to be sort of a sore spot for a lot of folks.
While we're on local politics, we had Linn County Auditor Joel Miller up here at the break talking about the elections, but then he mentioned how many people are running for mayor in Cedar Rapids. That's a lot of candidates driving around. There's a lot of different names on yard signs. Is that good? Is that good to have so many choices?
Well, it's a stepping stone to the governorship, so I think that's why there's so much interest. It's kind of the gateway. It's an open seat, and you know, it's in many ways, you know, Ron Corbett, the way he sort of built that job up from what it was. I mean, when the charter changed and we went to mayor council, it was sort of, you know, perceived as it was just one member of the council who got to, you know, cut ribbons and sign things. He made it into more of a leadership role after the flood, and I think it's a job worth having, and so lots of people are now interested in having it. It's a good sign that we've got a lot of candidates. It's a headache for me to schedule all the endorsement interviews, but I'll get through it. As Joel said, I mean, we've got dozens of candidates in all sorts of races. It's going to be a really interesting city election, and from now going forward, the school elections are going to be in city elections after, I guess, the next cycle around. So that'll be a very crowded ballot.
I think it's another indication of sort of the interest people have taken in politics And there's a lot of people who want to run for something. They are, you know, they, if you asked them a year ago, they probably weren't interested in running for anything, but now they're interested in running. So we have 81 candidates running in Linn County in, you know, for mayor, for city council, these races that sometimes don't attract anybody. You know, in smaller communities, you know, it's like, who wants the job? And nobody wants it, so they draw a name out of the hat or something. It's good to see the number of candidates. I hope they're all...
And they're, you know, they're coming from diverse backgrounds. I mean, it's not just the sort of, okay, which five people in the chamber are gonna run for city offices this time. It's a different field of candidates.
And that's where we end this edition of River to River, Pints in Politics, recorded yesterday evening at the Scottish Rite Temple in Cedar Rapids. Our producer and audio editor today, Lindsay Moon. Sound engineer, Jim Davies. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.